Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Heart Podcast. Our guests today are Goonzy and Steven from Bleed From Within. Let's get started. Goonzy and Steven, welcome to the Riff Heart Podcast.
How's it going, man? Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. So I want to hear about this voice memo thing, like how you use voice memos, because I just started using them in the past few months. You were mentioning that a lot of your writing comes from voice memos. So I'm curious if it's because you're doing something else at the time and you get the idea down. Do you sing it or do you play it? Like, how do you use them?
Almost always sing it. And it's always when I'm like in public. So I pretend I'm on the phone, but it's become just how I write now, or like how I start writing anyway. When you first get an idea and if you don't have a guitar at hand, it's the best thing to just not forget it, because I will forget it. And it just works out for me. Like, I don't, do you use voice
memos? I use voice memos as well in the exact same way, yeah.
Yeah, it's just... Yeah.
You sing it too?
Yeah, usually I sing it and then just work it out later. And, you know, it tends to always be the bare bones, like the very first idea, like, you know, a series of notes. And then, yeah, you actually, when you sit there and play it, and sometimes it sounds like shit, you know, like once you actually play it through a distorted tone. But yeah, I do it that way too.
I guess I don't actually sing it. It seems weird singing a riff.
I think riffs are born in my head, not on a guitar. Yeah. It's not very often that I write a riff just sitting and playing my guitar. It's usually in my head and I try and play it on a guitar, and that's the difficult part, getting it out of my head and onto the guitar. But I've got like a folder of, must be fucking like 200 voice notes from years ago that I've not dived into. Maybe we should do like the voice memo album at some point.
So the riff, do you hear it as if it's on a guitar, or is it just like some disembodied series of notes?
I think it's a bit of both, man. It can be both. It could be like a full production with like strings and everything, or sometimes it's just guitar, or sometimes like you could hear like something on the radio, like a pop song with like synth patterns, and that'll just give you an idea for something that could be a riff. And it's just like, yeah, like putting it in a diary so you don't forget it, because I know that I will.
Yeah. That's funny, because I'm not sure it's ever that realised in my head. Like, so hearing you say that's kind of like, what, really? You get strings and shit?
Like, you've like dreamt full songs before though, right?
I did dream a full song not too long ago.
That's weird.
Pretty weird. That was pretty weird.
So I dream music a lot. And when I'm dreaming, I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. This is fantastic. But like, I'm not sure that's true, you know, because you're dreaming. So you don't really, I mean, lots of weird shit that's not connected to reality happens. So it could be that you just think it's cool, but it actually sucks. And it might not even actually sound like anything. But then again, I have gotten ideas and dreams that I've then woken up and figured out, and they've been good. So I don't know. I feel like in dreams, they're like, I get these ideas that I wouldn't be able to think of.
I mean, waking up would be prime opportunity to just like take your phone and sing it into your voice memo, you know? So I know earlier on you were asking like, oh, why do you do that? It's that exact reason. It's like when you get the idea in that moment, you don't want to lose it forever, you know, because I will forget and so will you. So you just sing it into your phone.
Into the ether.
That's it.
Yeah. I do use voice memos a lot, but it's usually like if I'm practicing or working on one thing, and then another idea happens and I don't want to lose it, because I will lose it.
Yeah, I try and name mine, so when they connect to maybe riffs I already have, or like when we write a song and there'll be something that's the same tempo or the same tune or whatever, like I'll try and name it, like go through them, and I maybe got through like 10, but there's, like I said, there's hundreds there. I don't know if we'll ever get through them.
Probably not.
There could be some real gold in there somewhere. Yeah. Who knows?
So far, so good, eh?
Yeah.
How does that make its way into being a song?
I think the last album, anyway, we kind of took the approach of just filling up a Dropbox folder with as many ideas as possible, whether that be just a riff or a few riffs or like most of a song. So the sort of idea for me for a while was going through my voice notes, turning them into actual songs, like recording them and just getting them in the Dropbox, or just like riffs, just so you can like let the other guys hear it and see if there's any potential there. Like, even if I don't see any potential in something, someone else in the band might, or they might have an idea that they can add to it, even if I'm totally my mind is totally blank with it.
Yeah. And I guess the step between the voice memo and there is figuring out what you've sang in the voice memo and maybe like improving it a little bit as you're recording. Yeah. Putting the drums to it as well, which is, that was actually something I was going to say earlier. It's like, I don't hear drums in my head, but you can like feel the tempo, you can feel the beat, you know, like when you're singing into your phone, like a wee riff or whatever, you kind of have an idea of what the drums are going to be. But yeah, it's hard to describe, I think.
Yeah, but whatever we program drums wise, Ali's going to change anyway. I think he makes a conscious effort to change whatever I do.
If there's any hi-hat pedals in there, he's just going to fucking take them right out.
I always put hi-hat pedals like in there and he just hates that, so they always come out.
I don't know why.
I don't think there's anything Ali can't do. I think he just recognises.
He's like, I just don't know why you would have me doing that on the hi-hat.
Yeah, he recognises when we do too much of one thing and really picks up on that, which is a good thing, I guess, because I don't. So.
Yeah.
When I did the guitar album with Sean Reiner, I didn't write a single fake drum whatsoever. I wrote everything, all my parts, to a click and then just gave it to him, because that dude used to compose parts, like really compose. So I felt like I'm just gonna be getting in the way of the dude doing his thing. It's like you have to get out of the heaviness headspace. Even if you are writing heavy music, there's other things that have to like take priority. I think heaviness and riffs are so much about rhythm and impact. And if you don't have that, got to think about other stuff. So, I don't know. It's a good challenge, though. But I do think that, like, super savage riffs, it's going to be hard to write that without drums. Because, like, I've always thought that, like, some riffs that are super badass in context of a song are really dumb. Like, if you just separate them by themselves, they're going to be really dumb. And, some, like, lyrics, too. Like, if you were to just, like, read lyrics out loud with no music to most metal songs. I'm not going to say it because get in trouble, but you're going to think not so nice things about, like, you know, the people writing its ability to like put sentences together. But like you hear it in context and it's fucking great. And context is everything, I think.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, that is why a lot of people now record drums last. And it's like why that's kind of becoming the standard operating procedure for heavy music recordings. It's weird because like traditionally there's always drums first, but like more and more top tier metal producers are doing drums last. It's like in the past 5 years it's become a lot more of a thing. And I know that like that's kind of a controversial topic and a lot of people disagree with that idea, but like there's a lot of logic to it. There's really a lot of logic to it. So if you're tracking to program drums, first of all, you know they're great in terms of timing. But also, more than that, if you are on a super tight deadline and the songs aren't 100% buttoned up, you're still changing a few things, it gives you room to experiment with things and change parts and then give the drummer some time to learn those parts so that then they can play them having rehearsed them, as opposed to trying to change things on the spot for the drummer. Good drummers, man, like even some really good drummers are not great at changing parts right on the spot and playing it. But also like just if you come up with ideas while you're tracking, it's a lot easier to then have the drummer learn those ideas and then track them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's the only way to do it or anything. Like the traditional way works great too. It is kind of becoming a thing for that reason.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because we actually had the exact conversation like 2 days ago, I think, Steve.
With Ali, yeah.
You suggested actually maybe doing drums last in the next album because we'd get to recording guitars and there'll be drum parts that we didn't notice that had changed from what we'd written and we have to change them last minute. But I get it is a lot easier to change a guitar part than it is recorded
and
drums.
And even a vocal, and literally everything except for drums. Drums are the hardest thing to change. Sometimes you just can't. So when it's been recorded live, so it's like, yeah, you just save all that hassle, don't you? And I think it's a way more creative process as well if you leave drums till last, because you can be making changes right up till the very end, and yeah, you've got the room to experiment and improve.
People will say things like, well, yeah, but the feel's not going to be the same. But like, what the feel, if you have to edit the shit out of the drums to create parts that didn't exist, that's going to fuck with the feel a lot more than if you track guitars first and then the drummer plays it once, like plays it the way it's supposed to be. That will require far less editing than having to construct something that didn't exist before.
I definitely think that's something that we'll be implementing moving forward. We did literally just speak to Ali about that, and he was like, I'd be down to try, which is crazy because Ali's such a traditional guy, isn't he? I never thought he would be into the idea, but I think we'll probably do that next time around.
It's interesting because, like, lots of great drummers I know, like, they just accept the editing and the samples as part of modern production. I feel like maybe 10 years ago, further back in time you go, the weirder they were about it. And I think also it's partially because people didn't used to understand triggers. I know we samples, but like they used to call them triggers back then. The triggers don't play it for you. And like a lot of people used to think that the triggers play it for you or something. And that somehow it's cheating, which is like they do it for you. You're not actually playing double bass, which is wrong.
I remember a few conversations where people used to think that they would make, like, double up the timing of your kick. Like, if you did one kick, it would make two. And I was like, no, man.
Yeah. Oh, that's a misfire.
I don't think it matters too much these days when you're doing a record. Like, you're going to know if someone can play it when you're standing in front of them at a show.
Yeah.
Like, a record's, like, forever.
Exactly.
So it needs to just sound the best it possibly can. But
I agree.
Like I've seen an interview with Courtney from Spiritbox, and she just came out and said, oh yeah, we just use program drums on the record. And I thought that was kind of bold, but then the more I thought about it, I was like, everybody probably does it. A lot of people do that. Yeah. So does it really matter?
No. Meshuggah did it.
What?
Yeah. Fear Factory did it too on an album.
That makes more sense to me.
Yeah, but like they've always had drummers who can play that stuff. Fear Factory and Meshuggah are kind of like different sides of the same coin. Like they came out at around the same time. They're like two first bands to get big with like hyper pattern work where people are like, is that real or can people actually do that? Like they were like the two first bands I can think of that really, really took that thing to the pseudo mainstream of metal. And both of them have had a record with programmed drums. It's just, it's funny that, and both those bands can play the shit out of that stuff.
Yeah, that's the most important thing, yeah.
So you guys had some string quartets on your record.
Yeah, they definitely cost money.
Yeah, you can't skimp on that because thing with strings is they're either good or they're terrible.
Yeah, we were using like Logic strings for like three albums, and like we got like a bit of a better budget than when we signed to Nuclear Blast, and we're like, let's just fucking go for it this time. Like there was a good seven or eight songs that had strings programmed for it, and we're like, right, let's get someone in to compose all this like properly, because I'm just like punching MIDI notes and I don't really know what I'm doing. But we've got a guy called Simon Dobson involved who done like Architects Live at Abbey Road and the Bring Me Horizon thing, and he absolutely smashed it. Like it's next level. I think you can tell, well I can tell when I listen to it. Yeah. It's just another texture. It doesn't sound fake because it's not.
And who was it? It was Parallax Orchestra that went to Middle Farm Studios, and was it just Pete Miles? Just
Pete
engineered it, and Simon conducted, and it turned out great, man. Definitely way better than the stuff that we were throwing down in MIDI, like you say, you know, just like three octaves of this note.
You write the string parts just on your own, kind of just doing what you think sounds cool. And then what was the process for translating that to something that can be done in reality?
So I think I sent over the MIDI and just like the audio stems to Simon. And then he like transcribed it all. Transcribed's not the right word, what's the word?
I think you're
scored
right.
It. He scored it all.
Okay, right.
Properly. And then like he sent me Sibelius, he sent like that over the scores and the audio from that. And we kind of like had a few calls just making sure we're on the same page. And then it all happened really quickly, man. He was in the studio before we know it, and we were on like a live call, like as audio movers, where you put it on like the master bus, and we were like listening to the strings being recorded while they were being recorded, which was really cool, which I've never experienced
before. Was that when we were doing drums? Did you go and sit in a different room? Or?
No, it was like totally separate.
It was totally separate?
Yeah. I want to say we did the strings before drums.
Jeez, no, well, I remember a conversation while we were tracking drums at Real World, when we were sat on little couches in the wee outhouse, and you were like sorting things out with Simon. It must have been just
that's true. It must have been just, that was an experience for sure.
The chef is unbelievable. He's so fucking good.
Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, when you had like a, I guess your, we'll call it formative label experience, is it something where you went with it because you felt like getting signed was worth the risk? Like, did you know the stories about this label in advance? Or were you going in blind? Like, what got you into that situation?
We were kids, basically. I think we were okay. still teenagers at the time. And we had some mates who were on the same label and they kind of recommended it. And it just didn't turn out well for any band on that label. But yeah, we were just naive and didn't know any better. And it was excitement of there's a label interested in us and no one else was interested in us. We didn't know that you could shop around for labels at that time. We just thought, all right, this is our chance. Let's take it. And yeah, didn't work out great.
So the question I have, though, is, so you had a bad label experience and now you're on a good label. You're Nuclear Blast now. As bad as the experience was, did it help you get to where you are now?
Oh, for sure, man. Like, lessons learned. I think we as a band have made every mistake there is to make, but hopefully we learn from it. So that was definitely a learning curve, man, for sure. But it gave us sort of insight what to look for when we were like getting some serious label offers. And they actually, like the new label, Century Media at the time, they actually helped us get out of our situation with like pointing us the right direction of lawyers and stuff. So,
oh, I thought you were with Nuclear Blast.
We were with Century Media in between. So we're with the Nuclear Blast now, but we were with Century Media for three albums.
Got it. Okay. And then one before that.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm wondering is, like, just being on a label, did that help you? Like, because it looks like things worked out in the end. So, like, even if it was a fucked up situation, you know, learning experience, like, just did that elevate the status of the band enough to be able to move forward?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, I think people view, if you're on a label, if you're signed, then you're somehow like above other bands. That's a perception thing, I think. And I guess in that sense, that helped.
Yeah. I mean, would Century Media have known about you unless you had a shite time with...
That's true, yeah.
Spising.
All part of the journey.
Yeah, it's weird because, like, getting signed, we all know that there's a lot of illusion about what getting signed means. But the one thing that's not an illusion is that it does give your band almost like legitimacy.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, it does. Like, people take you more seriously.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
I wish it wasn't the case, but it's totally the case.
Yeah, and it's funny because now a lot of bands are getting to the end of their contracts and they're so big that they just don't need labels anymore, you know? So it's funny how it kind of works that way.
Definitely a good stepping stone when you're starting off as well. Like,
yes.
To get you going on your journey, and you learn a lot of things about the music industry on the way through the different people you meet through these different labels.
Well, I think if you're already established and been on labels and then you go indie, that's different. If your name's already been out there on labels, it's different.
I agree, yeah. It's just a funny little cycle, isn't it? How you start in almost like a similar position to where you end. Just in that sense, you know, no label.
Yeah, totally. Are you on Monty Connor's Nuclear Blast?
I have heard that name. Yeah. Me and Stephen don't really deal with the label side of thing. That's mostly Ali. Ali's like our manager, pretty much. So
yeah, the guy that we did talk to was Jens.
Yeah, Jens. He actually.
Yeah, he's cool.
He actually was the guy that signed us to Century, and then moved to Nuclear Blast like not long after. And then he was the guy that signed us to Nuclear Blast. So yeah. It's cool having like a mate there as well.
That really makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah. Having that personal connection, man. He's a great guy, man.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. Yeah, like, if you don't have a personal connection with somebody at a label, like, it becomes a lot more difficult because I think what a lot of people don't understand is that a label is many people working together, and they have lots of bands. Like, and so to get all those people at the label with all their different jobs on the same page about a band when... You know, they each have their favorite bands. To get that all coordinated, it's a lot easier to have that happen and to work in your favor if you have friends at the label.
Yeah, definitely.
More than one is usually good, but still, like, having at least one that really, really gives a fuck is a huge, huge deal.
Exactly. Yeah, these people that work at labels, it's more than just paying their bills. You know, it's something that they care a lot about. Especially, we found that with everybody that we're dealing with at Nuclear Blast. You know, it's crazy the amount of passion these people have for, like, you know, the tunes that we are shouting out in voice notes. But it's awesome as well, you know, and like you say, definitely personal connections, you know, somebody who's going to like fight your corner in the office and be like, you know, make sure you're doing that for these guys. And yeah,
I think
people that actually care.
One of the other reasons we chose them over everyone else was honesty. Like, a lot of the other labels were like, yeah, just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing great.
Blowing smoke up at ours.
Yeah, exactly. But Nuclear Blast were like, yeah, you're doing okay, but here's what you can do to get better.
Then we'll do it with you, sort of thing. And you're saying we're going to do it.
So we really appreciated totally that sort of honest angle.
I'm curious, if you don't mind sharing, what did they tell you could do better?
Well, they looked at our streaming numbers, which for The End of All We Know and a bunch of other songs in Fracture were really good. And they were kind of like, yeah, but look at how it doesn't translate to your followers and some other stuff like that. That was definitely one of the things that stuck out like a sore thumb for us, was like, you know, they were looking at the thing that we were technically doing best at and being like, nah, you can do it better. So we were like, yeah, let's do better.
we don't want people to bullshit us, man. That's what we really liked about them is, it's not blowing smoke up your arse, Lisa.
I can't stand yes, man. It helps nobody. Just being straight up about what needs to be better is way more useful for everybody. I think that lots of labels take this approach of just saying, yeah, it's great, yeah, it's great, because a lot of artists don't do well with the truth.
Yeah, probably.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
They just don't do well with it. But bands that are going to do well long term need to be able to face reality and figure out how to deal with it. You need a team that's going to be straight up with you about that stuff.
For sure.
Yeah, I think longevity is our main aim. Like, we've been a band for 17 years now.
Yeah.
It's our sixth album that's just came out. So, like, and we don't plan on stopping anytime soon. So longevity is the goal. And it's good to have a team of people behind you that also have that goal in mind.
17 years, huh?
Yeah. And it's still not paying off. It's just starting to pay off, I'd say, in the last few years. Yeah. I don't mean money-wise. I just mean...
Seeing the rewards and the sense of getting to do killer shows.
The fruits of your labour. Yeah. You get a lot of flash in the pan stuff that then leads on to longevity. Like, fans that just get massive on the first album and that's them set for life.
Yeah.
But we haven't been that band. It's been a slow burner, but we seem to be kind of keeping pushing it and getting bigger on every album. Like,
it's always going up, man. It's in the right trajectory, you know. I think because the five of us all actually really, 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 really give a fuck, it makes such a difference, you know, because we could have given up so, so long ago. You guys certainly could have, you know.
We almost did before you joined the band. You were like the new blood that
kept you needed going. A kick up the arse, didn't you?
Yeah.
So I remember doing a podcast with Devin Townsend, and he was talking about working with Chad Kroeger.
Legend.
Yes. Yeah. Like, they had a project together. Okay. Chad Kroeger, Devin Townsend. So interesting lineup, but
amazing combination.
Right. But it did. I don't think their project worked out in the end, but like, he had nothing but good things to say about Chad. And what Devin was saying is that Chad doesn't try to write that kind of stuff. That's who he is. Like, that is his artistic expression. Like, he's not faking it or trying to sell out or like any of that kind of stuff. Like, that's the music that dude writes. Lucky for him.
Some people are just born with it, man.
Yeah. They're just tuned in to something that resonates with large amounts of people. But like, he's not like into Deicide and Cannibal Corpse and like secret death metal dude or something, and then had to like be like, no, I need to make money. I'm doing Nickelback. It's nothing like that. That's just what he does.
Yeah.
I feel like Nickelback's another dirty word, but again, I don't know why. Like, you have like 5 or 6 pints at a Nickelback show and tell me you've not had the best night of your life, you're lying.
Best mixes in the game, for sure.
we saw them at the Hydro in Glasgow, and like one of the first things I noticed was that the guitar tone was actually amazing. And I was like, why is it so good? It's Nickelback. Like, it sounded like a really, really great metal tone. I was like, how are they doing this?
Mate, they're unreal. Like, Burn It to the Ground's my karaoke song, yeah. Always.
Yeah.
That's Riff City, though, and that's Riff City, that song.
I feel like when you see those types of bands, those really huge bands, even if you don't listen to them, if you go see them, you realize why they're so huge. Like, I'm a Korn fan, but it wasn't until I saw them live that I realized really why they're so huge. Like, and this is me being a Korn fan, but like, when you go see them live, it's just like, wow, I know that song. Oh, I know that song. I know that song. I know that song. Okay, there's that hit. There's that hit. There's that hit. There's that hit. For like 2 hours straight, it's just like hit after hit after hit after hit after hit. And even from the time periods where you think they had fallen off, there's still hits from that time period. Like, their career is like a steady stream of hits, even from their worst time periods. You see them live and it's just like, yeah, of course this band's fucking huge. And I imagine that what you were saying about Nickelback and their tone is like, you see them live and it's just like, yeah, of course. Of course they sound like this.
You just need to give in and enjoy it, I think. A lot of people are too cool for Nickelback, but you just need to give in and love it. I had the pleasure of touring with Nickelback once when I was filming the support band, and at the Glasgow show, Chad Kroeger just decided he was going to chat up my girlfriend and kept asking if she was single, and he was so drunk that I told him no like 5 times and he just kept forgetting, and she asked for a picture and he picked her up. So I have a photo of Chad Kroeger just carrying my girlfriend.
Amazing. Amazing.
Okay, so he physically picked her up.
Yeah, physically.
Not picked her up.
No.
Okay.
Oh, right. Yeah, so that was lost in translation, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was like, oh no, this story's dark.
No, it's not. It's happy. Happy ending.
It's like,
he might have lost some of his perfectly white teeth otherwise.
I mean, you know, dark stuff happens. But yeah, I'm glad that that's what the story is that picked her up physically. So what were you doing on tour? You were filming somebody?
Yeah, Monster Truck was the support band, and I was out filming those guys for a few shows with Nickelback. So that was a cool experience.
Like, we're real close to the end of this, but speaking of filming, can we talk about 12 Inch Media some?
Sure.
I noticed that you've done a ton of stuff.
Yeah, we've been busy.
Yeah, what's the story with 12 Inch Media?
Basically, we couldn't afford to pay people to do like animation stuff for us or like lyric videos. So I just learned by watching like YouTube tutorials. And it's always like kids who make these After Effects YouTube tutorials. And so that's how I learned to do my job. That's now my job. But a couple of the other guys in the band also do it along with me, Scott the singer and Davey the bass player. So it's like a little band business that we can all do on tour. But yeah, it's like motion graphics, lyric videos, do stuff for a bunch of bands and brands. And yeah, it's cool just getting to do something that runs alongside the band and kind of integrates within the band, and we could do it on tour. And yeah, it's cool.
It's awesome. Yeah, I mean, it looks super legit. All right, dudes. I think this is a good place to end the episode. I want to thank you both for taking the time to hang out with us.
Thanks for having us, man.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure. And again, I apologize for the little late start there. Thanks for waiting on me.